Well, I'd like to say good evening. And since I come from the far north, a place called Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we've been freezing to death, I woke up this morning, the temperature was 40, and we've had just an unseasonably cold spring. So I want to thank you. I came here today. And it was 92. I was just thought, thank you. It was a great gift of being in the Washington area. Great day, wasn't it? So I'd like to shift gears a little bit here and share with you some thoughts about the book that I've written called Aging with Wisdom. And I'd like to start with a few general observations about aging in our culture and then pick up some stories and highlights and inspiring pieces from the book and how they relate to our practice. So, you know, this started for me a long time ago. And if I were to be showing you the slides, I'm doing a talk tomorrow night at a St. John's Church in Georgetown, where I'll be showing these slides. I start with a slide of my Danish grandmother. And you might wonder why in the world that I'm 7 years old and I'm sitting with her. And the reason that I go there is that she is, from my childhood, the person that I remember who looked at me with total unconditional love and who loved me unconditionally. And she was old, and so I think it planted the seed for my loving old people. And of course, now the big surprise is that I am one. It's like, how does it happen? And I would just ask you to think back for a moment if there's somebody like that in your childhood who just loved you and who maybe helped plant some seed in you for loving older people. Because I really date it from there. Then things fast-forwarded in life, and this is really the background to this book, because my husband, Harrison, who was known as Hob, was tentatively diagnosed with Alzheimer's when he was 70, and I was 56. We had 14 years age difference. So what this meant was that I was kind of catapulted into dealing with older people's issues, my husband's issues, at a relatively young age. I mean, I know 56 may sound ancient to many of you in this room, but anyway, that's what I was. And our journey with this illness was really quite extraordinary. It's a strange thing to say, but he was a Dharma teacher. He was ordained as a Dharmacharya or a senior teacher by Thich Nhat Hanh. And I, too, was teaching. We were both psychotherapists, and we were both doing hospice work. So you could say there were many elements that helped us to handle the really heartbreaking losses that this illness brings. And ultimately, I ended up writing the book, and I just brought three copies with me, called 10,000 Joys and 10,000 Sorrows, A Couple's Journey Through Alzheimer's. And the book continues to be out there because I think our perspective, which of course was the perspective of and the wisdom of the Dharma, made an enormous difference in living through that illness. So that, too, was a contributing factor to my writing this book. Let me make a few cultural observations. I'm sure that this, probably I don't even need to say this, but have you noticed that we live in a youth-obsessed culture? And the other side of that is an age-phobic culture. Actually, when you start looking at indigenous cultures or Asian cultures, it has been said that this country is stuck in a kind of adolescent dream that's rooted in a kind of lack of realism about what life is like. And look at the energy that goes into trying to be youthful and into the denial of aging. Now, what happens with that is that you have a kind of cultural denial and repression And just speaking in Jungian terms for a moment, no big trip coming, but just to say that goes into the collective unconscious. And then it starts to come out in unconscious ways, and we see that. We see that in the media. We see it in jokes that have kind of a sharp edge, jokes about aging or about older people that have kind of a sharp edge to them. We see the kind of infantilizing language that some of us have experienced in the medical community, where we're talked to as though we're children. Oh, is that a rough one? Some of you know, don't you? This is the reality. This is where this country is. Age phobic, and where it's rooted in a fear of aging, because we're a youth obsessed culture. There was a leading editorial in the Boston Globe yesterday by a woman who was saying that people in her workplace, with the women, did not dare have a gray hair show because they felt that the security of their job would immediately be jeopardized by their age. Whoa, it was if I weren't coming here, I would have written a letter. I was found at a very distressing article about ageism in the workplace. So there's another place. So it's also propelled by fear of aging and death, because we're also a death-phobic culture. So these are big issues. Now, I want to just say one quick thing about a kind of paradox about aging, and you know this, but those of us who are gray hairs in this room, have you not said at some point or other, I can't believe I'm 70, or I can't believe I'm 81, I can't believe, do you know what I mean? You say that. And it's because it's only the body that's that age. Yeah, there's a reality to that. We have to deal with the aches and pains of that. But in fact, that's not our age. We are ageless because we are the age of that which we touch in meditation, pure awareness, our essence being. Who we really are is beyond the body, it's beyond our feelings, it's beyond the mind. And that, of course, is what the journey of meditation is partly about. So that leads me to a story. I want to start, actually, before I go into a story from the book, I want to tell a story from the other one. It's such a beautiful example of somebody who was prepared for the shocks of the later years. And this is a story about my own husband. Harrison was known as Hob. And this is a story I tell because I find it so inspiring. His journey was 6 years long, so he died at 76. So this was, I think, when he was about 74. And we were at a restaurant having dinner. And I noticed that he had fallen forward like this over his plate. And I said, Hobby, I call it that. Hobby, are you all right? Are you all right? No answer. He had passed out. Well, suddenly this restaurant, someone called 911. There was chaos. They came in. They took him out on a stretcher. I took one look at him. He was just sepulchral looking. He was ashen. I was sure he was dying. And this unconsciousness lasted for a very long time, or so it seemed to me. So they put him into the back of the ambulance, and they wouldn't let me go in with him, which made me extremely mad. But I went and sat in the front, but there was a window that went into the back that was open. And I heard them yelling at him. The EMTs were yelling at him, which is what they do. Harrison, Harrison, can you hear us? Can you hear us? And I saw him begin to stir. And then I heard him say, eyes still closed, will you guys please keep it down? I'm trying to die here. Now, I don't think EMTs ever heard that line before. Never. And I knew that that was what he was trying to do. In fact, my hair standing on end telling you this story because we had talked about dying together. He had said he didn't want to live into the late stages of this illness. He said, I'll find a way out. We talked very openly about it. So I knew that he was practicing dying. And I won't go into the rest of the details. Eventually, the next day after the hospital, he came home. And listen to what he said. These were his reflections the next day. He was pretty wiped out from this, I have to say. "Now that I have died once, I can use that as my guide. There's nothing scary here. It's not a big deal. In fact, it's just fine. If dying is this easy, no problem." How beautiful is that? In other words, near-death experience. Those of us who have had a near-death experience or studied the literature know that there is a really archetypal thing that happens, which is that we feel that we're being catapulted through a tunnel, and we come out into the light, and the light is unbelievable, totally peaceful, sublime, beyond anything words can describe. That's what he experienced. That's what people experience. And they don't want to come back. So I just put that out there as a wonderful teaching story because he was prepared. It was his practice that led him be in that place. Okay, so let me now go to this book. And what I want to do is, I'm thinking about a kaleidoscope. I want to give you a few pieces of bright colored glass, pieces from the book. And, you know, I was on a talk show last week, I guess it was, an hour-long talk show, you know, radio when people listen in. And she asked me, "What's the main message of this book?" I thought, geez, what a question. I guess I'm supposed to know the answer. So, but it was really thought-provoking. I said, well, I said two things. I said, I think that really our lifetime is about turning the compass, which is turned toward ourselves so much of the time, I, me, mine, my story, my narrative, my life, outward, turned outward towards the other, towards people, towards service, toward help, towards responding to the cries of the world. So that's one thing. But then the other that I said was I really wanted to share with people the things that have inspired me, that have inspired my practice. And so I've collected these things. I call them wisdom treasures. There's a whole section of the book called Wisdom Treasures. And I just love collecting things that are inspiring. So I'm going to share a couple of them with you. But I have to be, what should I say, respectful Dharma talker and start with a very famous story, which I'm sure some of you know. But I didn't really take the fullness of this story in until I kept being up against old age and dying and death. And you may know the story I'm going to tell briefly is about the four heavenly messengers. Some of you know this story? Not too many hands are going up. Okay, well, it's about the Buddha. And back in those days, a long time ago, 2,500 years ago, as you know, he was born into a royal family. And his father was afraid that because the prophecy said that he would become a great teacher, his father was afraid to let him see the world, but kept him behind the walls, if you will, of the royal palace. So it wasn't until he was in his 20s that he went outside the palace with his charioteer. And for the first time, he saw old people. He saw an old man. And then on another trip, he saw a very sick woman. And then on another trip out, he saw a corpse. And he thought, is this the inevitable trajectory of life? Is this what it is, that we have to experience old age, sickness and death? But then he saw a wandering contemplative, a monk. And this monk, I wish it had been a nun, but it was a monk, had the face of deep serenity, of equanimity. And that really caught his interest because he realized, he had a vision that it is possible to transcend, if you will, the challenges of old age, sickness, and even death through deep meditation practice. And that's when he left the palace and went out to do 6 years in the forest, if you will, of intense practice, which led to his ultimate enlightenment. So they're called the four heavenly messengers: old age, sickness, death, and the monk. Now you could say, why are those heavenly messengers? There's nothing heavenly about them. And I want to acknowledge here, because I'm such an incurable optimist and I am determined to always look for the best in things, that old age can be brutal and heartbreaking. We know that. In fact, I say in the book, it is the most heroic phase of life. Why? Because in those later years, our energy is diminished. We may be dealing with a life-threatening illness or with chronic pain or with big challenges, and yet we haven't got the sort of limitless energy of youth. So think about people in your life who you know who've perhaps had some illness and how they've handled it. I have many of these people who have been great way showers for me about how to handle the later years. So that's one story that just has to be there. It's kind of an iconic story. I was for a while in a devotional tradition from India, and that's when I heard about the four ashramas, the four stages of life. And this really struck me because now I'm in the third stage. So very briefly, I won't give you a big rap on this, but the first stage is brahmacharya, which is the first more or less 21 years of life when we're being educated, going to school, getting ready for whatever work we're going to do or family, whatever it's going to be. Then the next phase is, what is it called? Brahmanastra? Can't remember the name of it. Anyway, it's the householder and marketplace stage. It's where you have a family, if you have a family, where you go to work. You're in that very, very engaged part of life. But then, it says, when you start to get gray hairs, or you start to be a grandparent, you enter what's called the forest monk stage of life. This is where I am. Forest nun stage of life, perhaps. Anyway, and it is assumed in that culture, in the traditional elements of that culture, that at that period of life, let's say it's in your 60s sometime, that of course you will want to spend more time on your spiritual practice, because that's what we're here for. In that culture, of course, they see the purpose of life is self-realization or liberation or enlightenment. That's why we're here in Indian culture. Tibetan is the same. In any case, I'm in the forest monk stage, I realize, forest nun stage. I have to get this straight. But it's difficult because we're still very engaged in life, and yet I can feel in myself a deep pull to be doing longer, deeper practice. The last stage, the fourth, is called sannyasi. That's renunciation. That is only for a few who really go into, let's say, the nunnery, the monastery. They really renounce to do nothing but 100% practice. But let me just say something about this word renunciation. I've thought about it a lot. I've given talks about it. We tend to associate it with giving things up and a kind of austere feel to it. But it's really not what it's about. It's about finding freedom from our sense of limitation, from that sense that the ego has dominance over us and that we are caught up in our cycles of worry and agitation and stress and all this. It's freedom from that. That's what we long for. And I think that that knowing that that's a longing of the heart. Don't you know what I mean? The longing of the heart that comes, that is what gets you to your cushion or your chair to meditate or makes you want to do a retreat or whatever that is. That's what renunciation is really about. So Let me go on and tell you another story from the book. I was privileged to be with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, actually in Radio City Music Hall, of all unlikely places, where he, I went, must have been three different times he did teachings there. And, you know, they turned it into the most beautiful, I mean, I think rockettes, right, or whatever, or, you know, singers, pop singers, whatever. But they put this this great golden silk hanging against the far wall, and they hung a huge tonka there, and they had a raised dais so he could be seen by everybody. And then there must have been 75 nuns and monks on the stage on either side of him. And the place felt like a temple. And so he gave us teachings for 3 days. And the story that he told made a real impression on me. He told a story about an old man in the time of the Buddha who had led a very humble life, had been a farmer, and he was in his late years, and he wanted terribly to receive the teachings. So he found the Buddha's encampment, and he came in where there were a lot of monks, maybe there were nuns too, around, and he spoke to one of the senior nuns, and he said, please, will you initiate me? Will you give me teachings? I want to enter the path of the Dharma. And the monk said, old man, it's too late for you. You have not practiced it. You won't be able to learn now. So he basically rejected him. And the old man, who looked very much like a beggar, sat down by one of the tents and very disconsolate and just wondering what he was going to do when the Buddha walked by and stopped and said, sir, what is it? What is it? What can I do for you? And the old man explained what had happened. And the Dalai Lama said, the Buddha said, some of my monks don't realize that just because the body is old, there's still every reason to practice. All you need is courage and enthusiasm to study and meditate. I know you have insight and the roots of virtue. I will care for you. And the Dalai Lama added, he said, there's no reason to feel old just because the body is old. The mind can still be young and full of enthusiasm. He said, we can always have the courage to carry on, no matter how old we are. It was beautiful to hear him say that. And of course, he was then himself, just about 4 years ago, I can't do the math, but he was almost 80. And, you know, I understand he's not traveling. I'm not sure he's going to be back to the U.S., but in any case, this is a beautiful story. So coming back to this image of a kaleidoscope, another piece of stained glass window. This is from Dogen, who was the 13th century founder of the Soto School of Zen Buddhism. Any of you who are grandmothers here, if there are any besides me, you're going to find this really heartening. This is what Dogen said. You can understand all of Buddhism, but you cannot go beyond your abilities and your intelligence unless you have Robaishin, grandmother mind. Robaishin means grandmother mind, the mind of great compassion. So again, you can understand all of Buddhism, but you cannot go beyond your abilities and your intelligence unless you have Robaishin, grandmother mind, the mind of great compassion. So in East Asian languages, the word shin also means heart mind. And so what he is saying is that we grandmothers, and I can say for sure, our heart has been broken open so many times that's where our compassion comes from. It's such a hard teaching, but it's really the gifts of adversity that opens the heart of compassion. And I have to say, you know, having lived through a mother who had Alzheimer's, a husband who had Alzheimer's, now because of where I am in the life cycle, the death of many dear ones, the heart does break open. You know, we go through such periods of loss and grief and all the rest, and yet what does it do? It connects us to each other. And so I just feel that this statement of Dogen's is a real treasure. All right, one more of my favorites. This one came to me actually when I was about 40. I was in a small meditation group, and several of the people in that group were the next generation, so they were in their 60s and 70s, and one of our beloved friends was living with cancer. And Mary, we had stopped over the summer, we met again in September, and she came holding, well, this will date me. Do you remember, any of you here, those things called aerograms? They were light blue paper, very, very thin. I see a few head shaking. This is the camaraderie of those of us who know what aerograms are. None of you have ever seen one. They don't exist anymore. It was called airmail paper. You know, doesn't it? Gone. Anyway, so she was holding this piece of paper, and she said, I have just received the most important message from this friend of mine in Europe. She said, it's a quotation from Teilhard de Chardin. He was the French priest, mystic, philosopher, a great visionary, an extraordinary human being. And apparently, he wrote these words. In my younger years, I thanked God for my expanding, growing life. But now, in my later years, when I find my physical powers growing less, I thank God also for what I call the grace of diminishment. I thank God also for what I call the grace of diminishment. Well, I heard those words. As I said, I think I was about 40. And I said, that's an important message. And I went home and I started a file. And I called it Aging and Wisdom. And, you know, little did I know that all these years later that there would be a book called Aging with Wisdom. And the reason that I wanted to share this particular quotation with you, I call this a wisdom treasure, because when I was living with my husband during this long, difficult illness, I would occasionally remember this, the grace of diminishment. And you might say, well, what's so great about diminishment? Who wants diminishment? I don't want diminishment. But if you, and this is the wonderful thing about the Dharma, it's always inviting us to look more deeply, to look beyond the surface into the deeper possibilities of meaning. And diminishment, well, when we get older, life simplifies. It has to. There's a certain joy to that, I have to say. We want to downsize and simplify. Oh, joy. Then the smallest things start having more impact, because somehow, you know, we just realize life is very precious. We don't know how long we have. And so the smallest things somehow take on greater meaning, and it takes less to bring us joy or contentment. So anyway, the grace of diminishment. How do we find grace in adversity? I think this is something very worthy of contemplation. All right, so here's another very thought-provoking piece from the book. Master Shen Yen. He was a very revered Chan Buddhist master. He lived until he was 79, and he died in Taiwan in 2009. And as is true in some of the Mahayana Buddhist traditions, the teacher, when the teacher knows that he or she is dying, very often comes up with some last message. And so the students kind of wait for this. In fact, there's a wonderful book called Graceful Exits that gives one story after another about how great beings died and what they said or what they did at the end. It's very inspiring. And so he wrote a poem, just 4 lines long, and I'll read it twice because it deserves thought. Busy with nothing, growing old, within emptiness, weeping, laughing. Intrinsically, there is no I. Life and death thus cast aside. All right, listen again, and I'll unpack it a little bit. Busy with nothing, growing old. Within emptiness, weeping, laughing. Intrinsically, there is no I. Life and death thus cast aside. Now, this is the totally surrendered life, because first of all, busy with nothing, he's existing in a state of pure being, accepting the growing old part. It's natural. It's in the natural order of things. Okay, here's a profound line. With emptiness, weeping, laughing. Because, of course, the great teachings about emptiness from this tradition reveal to us that all is pervaded by the ephemeral, by impermanence, by emptiness. And it can include and hold everything, both the weeping and the laughing. And so sometimes people think, well, some of these enlightened masters, they won't show extreme emotions. Oh, no, that's not true at all. Sometimes a Zen master will break down and cry hard over some loss because it can hold, the emptiness can hold everything. Doesn't mean you stop feeling. In fact, perhaps you feel more deeply because you know that it'll move through you very quickly. In fact, that reminds me of another story I wasn't going to tell, but I will. Well, I better wait, let me finish with the poem. So he says, intrinsically, there is no I. He's gone beyond any sense of I. There is no I. That's what the teachings are trying to reveal to us, that we are that pure awareness, that essence being that is beyond any sense of the limited I or me or mine. Life and death thus cast aside. In other words, he's gone beyond the opposites of life and death. He's in non-dual consciousness. He's in a completely free state. So this poem, it just seems to embrace everything. And it opens to us the liberating possibility that we too can touch that place. We too can experience that freedom. That's what is so wondrous about those 4 lines. I love it. So anyway, here's the story about the Dalai Lama that just came to me, because I think it's a very powerful story. Again, he was teaching in New York, and he was giving the teachings about the highest, you know, about Manjushri and the wisdom teachings and kind of the most sublime teachings out of the Buddhist tradition. And, you know, most exalted kind of teachings. And he suddenly stopped in the middle of what he's saying. And he says, but that's not the way it is. We suffer. We feel so much pain. And he put his head down and he started to weep. He felt suddenly the suffering of the world. And he let it come into him. And he put his head down. He wept. He wept openly in front of 3,000 people. And then he sat up, he blew his nose, and he went on. It's like it went through him just like that. And it was just such a powerful teaching to those present that we can be afraid of our powerful emotions. But when we've reached that state of such a steady core, of course, what he has, this enlightened being that he is, he can share his grief, his momentary grief, and then move on and go right back to those sublime teachings. thought that was amazing. All right, let me just see. I have a little more time. Let me tell you another story from the book. This is another one of those wisdom treasures. This one comes from a friend of mine who was blind. And she had been really a way shower for me. I love this term way shower because, let me just back up a moment and say, isn't it true that we all have mentors in our life, people who have guided us, who've gone before us, who've initiated us into a job or whatever it is? And they're called mentors, but I like to think of those who've gone before us in their aging and in the last chapter of their life as way showers. They show us how to age gracefully, how to age consciously. To me, these are the way showers. So in the book, I actually have profiles of six people who have been that for me in particular. Well, this story, this is a woman named Blanche Mathias who lived in California, so I didn't get to see her very often. And when I went out the last time, she was 94, and she'd finally lost all of her vision. And so I was sitting with her, and I said, it was the first morning, and I said, Blanche, I said, what is it like for you? How are you managing now that the sight is completely gone? And we had that kind of relationship. I could ask her that. And she was physically very frail at that time, and she would wear glasses that were slightly tinted because she couldn't see. And she cocked her head to one side, and she said with a lot of assurance these very simple words, I try to treat everything as new experience. I try to treat everything as new experience. Well, you could say, that's nothing very special, but it really is. If you want mindfulness encapsulated in one sentence, you've got it right there. And if you, for a moment, just imagine what it's like, if you close your eyes for a moment and you think what it would be like to be blind, and maybe there are people in this room who are visually impaired or blind, and just think for a moment of your apartment or your house and think about what it would be like to find your way to making a cup of tea or whatever. And Blanche said, I treat every moment as new experience. Think of it. And those words were such an inspiration to me because they are wise and inspiring. So that's a wisdom treasure. Okay, I think maybe I'm going to start coming to a conclusion here. I could tell you a lot more about this book. It was a meditation for me to write it. Any of you are writers, I created an altar. I always kept flowers on it, very simple, something from the garden. I always did introductory mantras, which I chanted before I wrote, so that I would be open to something beyond myself. And then the writing was very much of a kind of meditation and very much, I would say, the fruit of practice, filled with stories and reflections and teachings, definitely with a strong Buddhist thread. So how to conclude? First of all, I personally feel so passionately about needing to overturn this ageist paradigm that we live in the middle of. And I'm very committed to that, and I really love talking about this subject because I feel like we need to inspire each other. You know, it's so wonderful because there are all these baby boomers coming along. Many of you here are that. And you all, besides us who are beyond that, I mean, I'm not in that category, got to do it. We've got to bring in new values about aging, about honoring our elders. Here's one more story. I have to tell you this one too, because this is about aging in another culture. I met a new friend about 3 years ago, a retired Delta Airlines pilot. And on our first meeting, he told me how he and his wife moved to Phnom Penh in Cambodia because their only son lived there and she had been diagnosed with dementia, with Alzheimer's. And he said, we wanted to go and live and be near our son. And he said, they were the happiest 6 years of our life. I said, would you say more about that? The happiest 6 years of their lives, he said, were the 6 years that his wife was living with and then dying from Alzheimer's. He said it was all the culture. He said we moved into a neighborhood and our neighbors embraced us because we were older. He said, I have white hair. I call it white hair syndrome. They would greet me in the street. He said, once I was going down some steps, I started to trip. Somebody was right there to catch me. Every morning when I went out to get the bread, the drivers in the tip-tips, or whatever you call those little three-wheelers, would wave to me and say, good morning, Papa. This is in Cambodian. Good morning, Papa. Good morning. And listen to this. He said, we'd go to a restaurant, and I would order for Narina. That was his wife's name. And he said, before I could pick up a fork to feed her, I would see somebody on their knees beside her feeding her. You wouldn't see that here. He said, we felt so embraced and included and honored and respected. He said, that's what made those 6 years so special. Well, I heard that story, and I felt very wistful about some of the patterns that we have to live with. So we need to bring back this respect and honoring of the elderly. We need to rejoice in our wrinkles. How about that one for a new line? We need a face that is full of lifelines, shows a life that has been fully led. You know, it's a beautiful thing. There's beauty in old age. We need to see it that way. So that's one of my first concluding points. And again, as I said before, the last chapter of life is the most heroic. And if ever there is a time when the Dharma can be there for us, it's in this last chapter. It's where our meditation practice hopefully has really taken root, where we feel called to it, where it has created the kind of inner resilience. I love that term, inner resilience. This is what we need. And this is what comes to us through a dedicated practice. Inner resilience, that's what comes. So, again, you know, going back to that story of the four heavenly messengers, that's a real mind bender, isn't it? That you could look upon those things with that framework, with that vision, but that's the deepest understanding. So then also accepting that death is a part of life. And when you polarize it and put it off and separate death from life, you cut off some of the vibrance of life. So looking at and accepting our own mortality is a very important part of our journey. And obviously, practice is our greatest ally in this. This is about cultivating the life of the spirit, which is really about our practice. And it then is the organizing principle in our lives. It's the most important thing. And so I want to end with the words of the philosopher George Santayana. He says, nothing is invincibly young except spirit. Nothing is invincibly young except spirit. And spirit can enter a human being perhaps better in the quiet of old age and dwell there undisturbed than in the turmoil of adventure. Again, let me just read this. Nothing is invincibly young except spirit, and spirit can enter a human being perhaps better in the quiet of old age and dwell there undisturbed than in the turmoil of adventure. So our ultimate refuge is our inner life. It's cultivating the life of the spirit through meditation and action, through living with wisdom and with compassion. So thank you very much for letting me be with you, and thank you so much.